Yeah, one of the things that Don Kiner here, I'll pick on, because he was a right-hand man in starting this program. He was the director of manufacturing engineering, and now he's moved up to senior fellow. But he had a real strong group that helped us get this launched. And there's a person that's missing here today that I was hoping to see, and that was Steve Milren from the Cell Systems, because their software is what enabled us to get this thing really looked at and go forward with it. So here's one of the charts that we used to start with was the F-35 is going to replace, you can see all the airplanes that it's going to replace. Now, one of the things I didn't know about this AV-8B, when we started the program, since we got the B model, you'll see in a minute, that if they have a load of munitions and they have to land vertically, they have to jettison it in the ocean. Mm-hmm. Don't have to do that with ours. So, anyway, I'll say ours. Here's the models that we're talking about. The one on the left is a conventional takeoff and landing for the U.S. Air Force. So it's a Model A. B is a STOVO for the U.S. Marine Corps in the U.K. And that one is the short takeoff and vertical landing. So it can land with some munitions on it. And the CV is the carrier version for the Navy. One thing you might notice, it's larger. Look at where the wings are on these two. Look where they are here. And the tails are larger. Horizontal. So that's a lot to do with the carrier landings. And I understand that. I've got 101 carrier landings in my background. Okay, here's the fighter team. Lockheed Martin being the main contractor on it with the partners at Northrop Grumman. They build the center fuselage. Then you have Pratt & Whitney, Rolls-Royce, and at the time we had GE on this. That might be resurrected in time, but so far it's not. It could cancel that part of it. BAE Systems does the aft section, the verticals and horizontals, from the UK. One of the things that you could look at is that lift fan for that B model right here. Rolls-Royce up in Indianapolis. Like that. And we'll talk about some of the problems we've had with that. Now, here is the manufacturing guy's nightmare. Supply chain. And this is still going on, as Mr. Kiner can attest to. One of the things I can say about Don, when I first got acquainted with him and we put him in charge of manufacturing engineering, he never goes around and displays doctor. And I found out he was a doctor in chemical engineering. I said, holy Michael, got a lot of brain power there. Let's use it. But anyway, this is definitely a nightmare. Looking at all, I'm not going to go over everything. I'm going to mention something later about this. And I don't want you to call me Islamophobe, but there's some problems here. Right now, Northrop Grumman is spending a lot of money with people over there. They're going to build a center fuselage for Northrop Grumman to go on this airplane.
And they delivered four of them already.
Yeah. So they started delivering sub-assemblies. Now they've done the whole thing. But a lot of problems. A lot of people that spend a lot of time in Turkey. We're coming all over the world with products, especially like the aft fuselage. We had a lot of discussions about transportation. And transportation, when you get to what we were supposed to get to, is one-a-day airplanes out of the plant. And you have that many on the ocean at one time, not a good thing. So we have to talk about air shipments and so forth. One of the things we'll get into is a lot of these people have a lot of talent. There's no doubt about it. UK especially, and Canada, Netherlands, Australia, and Denmark. Now, this is a dated chart, so I'm going to explain that. If you look at the colors here, this is what BAE Systems furnishes from the UK. They don't furnish this. At first, they were going to do the wing fold on the C version. And they said, we got our cup full. Take that back.
But it's theirs now again, though. It is back to them.
Again.
BAE is the lead for the wing fold now.
Yeah.
Move back and forth.
Fun.
The center fuselage, I said, is Northrop Grumman. You can see all the items that they are furnishing to us. And one of the big items is that radar. Prime contractor is Northrop Grumman. I like to say, well, we start with the forward fuselage and the wing. I want to make a comment about engineering. I can say that to the handle. And Don's heard me say that in front of engineering many times. I've gotten arguments with engineering over there over items. And the thing I said is I'm a registered engineer, professional engineer in the state of California. Where's your credentials? But anyway, that's another story. Build a wing and the forward fuselage. The forward fuselage was the only thing that came out on schedule. The only thing that came out on schedule, other than the center fuselage, but from North Lockheed's standpoint. The wing was the long pole in the tent, the hardest structure to build, and to get all the systems in place at the same time. This is the manufacturing system, and what we were supposed to be doing on this program is getting 1 day tack time, so not including weekends, by the way. 1 year order to delivery, 5 month assembly span. Got a long ways to go on that, huh? Mixed model assembly line. That is really unique to be able to put all three versions down the same assembly line with the adaptations that you have to do for the assembly fixture. The unprecedented affordability challenges that are facing this airplane, and especially since government, and part of it's Lockheed's fault too, not accelerating this rate. Everybody knows that you can't get the price down until you get quantities in the system, and that has not happened. Well, development, assembly, and formed by global partners, as we saw before. Here's the delivery schedule we had to begin with. If you look at that, I'll make one comment. You're just below 4 a month now. Next year, you're going to go over 4 a month. What, about 4.3, something like that, a month, supposedly. But look at this climb. If you look at 2015 out here, I went back and looked at my page that had all the different models and so forth on it. And this year we were supposed to deliver 178 airplanes. One thing I said at the beginning of this when we were talking to the Air Force, and well, let's talk about the program management out of the military. It rotates between the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Navy. So the head guy rotates. They're still doing that, I think, now.
They stopped. Bogdan's got the job until he decides he doesn't want it anymore.
3-star now.
Yeah.
But anyway, and that was a long hill to climb. When you talk about supply chain, that's the one thing that worried the heck out of me. And if whoever it was, a general or an admiral, that asked me what kept me awake at night, I said supply chain.
Ed, can I ask a question real quick?
Sure.
So with partner deliveries, right? As we've gotten to this point, we presumably start to ramp up the distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, with respect to the U.S. acquiring aircraft, that's going to be no problem. But once we start to push longer and longer out and have problems with delivery on partners, are we at all concerned about other countries reneging?
Well, right now, that rate is not very high. I mean, you've already delivered some for, I think you've got Denmark, right?
And well, some for the UK, some for Denmark, Norwegians have delivered a couple of Norway, the first few Italian ones, but it's all for training so far.
All right. Yeah. So that mixture, as you're say go back, I guess. But if you look at the color code down here, the blue is U.S., and then the partners are the pink color, and then the light yellow or almost white is the FMS, Foreign Military Sector.
Has anybody pulled out? I thought the Netherlands pulled out.
Well, the Netherlands just haven't bought yet, but we built two airplanes for them. The okay. Canadians are the ones with the new prime minister up there who said they don't want to buy it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's going to probably, if they decide really not to buy it and it's not just a political thing, then we probably will pull our work out of there and take it somewhere else.
Yeah, definitely.
You don't get work unless you buy airplanes. That's kind of fundamental. So.
That was the question I was going to ask. They were on the supply chain.
And they do a lot of business with us. I mean, Canada's got a lot of the business, so you know, we'll see what happens.
That's a nice segue to my next question, if you don't mind. With respect to supplier selection in those countries that are acquiring aircraft, to what degree is it Lockheed's choice, and to what degree is it? I mean, other than the fact that you only got really a certain number of suppliers you can pull from in that country, is it the countries?
It's really all Lockheed's choice. Okay. Lockheed, and of course we work with a customer, but it's really Lockheed. Or by the way, our partners, Northrop Grumman has business, and you know, BAE's got business in different places too. So,
okay. Yeah, and it's. Looking at the sustainment solution on this, this is something that in the government right now they still can't get their head around. And performance-based logistics, that's what that PBL stands for. I'm not going to read all these words for you, but got an integrated training system and information system, support system, and it's a highly supportable aircraft. If you look at the parts that we were making at the time, that I was there, and I think you still have some bulkhead problems, huh, getting those on time? Spars?
I want to say that we're not out of the woods. I don't know if you ever get out of the woods, but no. Yeah, but certainly we have our own issues with bulkheads and a lot of different things.
Now, one of the things I had the argument with the engineers on is when I found out that the aluminum parts on this airplane was going to be made out of 7050T651 material. I'd already had experience with that with the company I own, and that warps when you machine it. And I told the engineers that, can you stand annealing this and going back and doing a heat treat T6 condition? They said, we can't stand the difference in the properties. And I said, if we're that close on the margin, I'm not worried about it. So, anyway. That's another one of my pet peeves. The fundamental changes in approach to this airplane, if you look at the traditional service phase for the activity, government rights, repairs, just-in-case inventory, transportation, ad hoc reliability and maintainability, improvements in cost-plus contracting, and escalating life cycle costs. And that's what that on the left lower here shows you. That you know, the government's always complained about life cycle costing. They buy the article, and then they have to sustain it, and that cost outweighs what they paid for the unit originally. And here's one of the things that we were looking at was that performance-based logistics, and it's we'll get to that in just a moment. But it's really like pay by the hour in the commercial business, and that's what we were talking about doing, is if the plane's down, then that's a Lockheed problem. If it's up and performing, then they get an incentive to move forward to keep logistics going on that, and cutting the life cycle cost down. And this last chart here is the multiple year contracting, which doesn't look like we're going to get. And the government doesn't understand that at all. I've had arguments with the GAO. We had a CEO conference that the colonel was my alternate for the Air Force, and myself gave a presentation in front of all these CEOs, and there was one GAO guy in the audience. And we were talking about costs and so forth, and I said, GAO hasn't had a good idea in 20 years. and that got back to the head of the GAO. And but that was okay. Our chairman congratulated me on the presentation afterwards, but they haven't.
So
they're still doing the same old stuff.
There's not an multi-year like they do for the Blackhawks?
Nope. They've been talking about doing that. They've got one in the works right now, according to the news media. But you don't know if it's going to go over the year. The innovations for the program in manufacturing was the digital thread. And that's why I was hoping the other guy, Steve Miller, and you know him, Doc, was going to be here today, because he allowed us to do the simulations you're going to see later. They were the ones that had the Dell Mia package that was able to simulate this thing, and you're going to see that. The manufacturing initiatives, this was the big thing. When I started asking engineering what the tolerances were going to be on this airplane, and I had just come off of consulting on the F-22 program, I got put in charge of a blue team, they called, for engineering on the F-22. I had them change 108 drawings. And the reason for that was put producible. And so we were looking at those tolerances, and they said, well, it's going to be half of what it was on the F-22. I said, oh, my God, how are we going to do that? And the one thing is tolerance and having the equipment to tolerance the parts the way they should be. And the suppliers had to have CATIA so that we didn't have to transform the information to another system. That was one of the requirements, that you had to have CATIA for design. And so you got the solid model, and we call that the digital thread. That's the base for everything. And we had some problems with determining tolerances when we found out some of the suppliers didn't understand geometrical tolerance at all. So we had a guy working for me in QA at the time, because the first 3 years of the program, I had QA reporting to me also. So we sent the quality guy out to teach the suppliers what that meant. We went to automated drilling, and these particular machines that we came up with had not been built before. And there's a company out of Spain that's called M-Tories. A lot of people had automated drilling, or the Kerman uses them. I don't particularly like them because of tolerances, but that's all right. Automated checkout procedures. Now, that's a big one. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. The automated alignment of the mated components. Now, the first time that process on automated alignment was tried was on the C-17, McDonnell Douglas in Long Beach. And when they bring and I have witnessed this, when they started the alignment, it let the laser tell them where to go, and when the computer aligned everything, they still had to make adjustments of a 16th or an eighth of an inch. But since that time, the accuracy of the laser has come a long way. And machines that align it. Now we're going to have to go out of the Jerry. Going to have to go out of the presentation mode. And now this is okay. And let's see. Maybe I'm going to have to rely on you. Now this is a simulation. Can you click on that? No? Go back. Got to click on this. No?
He's working on it.
Yeah, you have to go out of presentation mode or it won't work. So what you're going to see is the simulations. I had three guys that were working on these, very smart fellows. One of them was a design engineer. The other two were manufacturing engineers that were working on the simulation. Before we had... okay, here we go. This is just to give you an idea of the structure. It's going to show that in a moment. See, here we go, looking at the structure. Kind of gives you an idea of how complicated this bird is with the systems in. Now, this was done before we had the airplane. And the simulation was, I had a complete assembly line for Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and BAE Systems that were simulated before we ever had parts in the jig, in the assembly jig. Okay, go off that one to the next one. at the time, you know, computers have come a long way. You wouldn't have to do this. This is the forward fuselage on B-1. Remember, the B model is the vertical landing capability, short takeoff. Now, this is the simulation of building the forward fuselage. And these are the work breakdown structures for each cost center. And we got preliminary designs out of engineering to do this with and started putting them together. And so we could find out what was going on, how we could move this. Now, one of the things that you'll see in here is, and I checked, now this is the picture of the actual structure. So what we did is we did the simulation. And I said, get a picture of the airplane and put it in here at the end on the forward fuselage and center fuselage and so forth. And right here, watch it, turns around. I said, why would we want to turn that around? Why wouldn't we just go right straight from the assembly jig into the next station for that forward? So we did. And there was a lot of things that we wanted to do that they had done, as you saw on the tour. We started out, we still had the F-16 in the building. We still had the F-22 midsection down the north end of the building. So we couldn't get our stuff in a line. Remember that argument? And we argued with that for a long time, and they finally refurbished Hangar 8 to put the F-16 in and get them out of the way. And, of course, as you know, the F-22 was canceled. And this goes through all the stations that you're seeing for the forward fuselage all the way to putting it into the main area. So this is all simulation software that is made by the subsystems. And there it is. There's the forward fuselage. Now, there's one thing to keep the gaps and so forth down. What we do is we make sure that we machine the inside of those skins. And we machine the structure. Still doing that, right? Machine the structure after you put some adhesive on them and build it up. And then they go to the machine it off so everything's net. Now, the first airplane, I took a 2,000 Steeler gauge, and we put just clecos. Clecos are temporary attachments that you put on the skins. I couldn't get the Steeler gauge in. I said, we got to fit. That's great. So now you see there's the article put together, and it's got to go over and get all the systems put in. Now, they don't do that U-turn anymore. As we straightened it out. But there it is. And you go to these areas here, and you'll get the shot in a moment that shows all the systems put into the airplane right there in the forward fuselage. So you see all the wiring, tubing, and all that kind of stuff. And then it goes, finishes up to install the final items, and that tool does rotate. There's another shot of the guys working on it. And then put the forward landing gear in. And so then it goes to the final. That's what you see next. But this simulation was a powerful tool. And when this ends, I'm going to make a statement about that. Here's another one where they rotated. We said, don't rotate it. Mm-hmm. Make a straight line. There it is at the assembly line meeting. Now, before we go to that next one, one of the things that this software has, it has one element of it. It's called ergonomics and ergoman, and you actually have a person-like figure that will demonstrate if they can get the things easily. So before we had parts, before we had an airplane, I went to engineering. I said, who is developing the fuel pumps for this airplane? The same company we had on the F-22. We had to change the fuel pumps out on the F-22 about every other flight. It was not reliable. And so I said, okay, I want a demonstration to tell me if I can get into that fuel pump easily. So when we did the simulation, you would have to have a joint right here in the middle of your forearm in order to get it out. So went to engineering and I said, you got a problem. So they changed the size and location of the cutouts, the access panels, to get to the fuel pumps. And the guy that had done this was also doing the electrical looking at the electrical routing, and he forgot you don't just plug electrical wires in. You've got to take the pump out sometimes to replace them. So that was one savings. There's many other examples, but I won't go into that. Okay, go to the next one, Jerry. This is a centrifuge lodge that Northrop Grumman builds, and this is a simulation. And by the way, their assembly line now is all changed too. It's got more automation in it than it had, and I remember when I got the bill. And by the way, the startup of this program for manufacturing and production, I had a $3 billion budget to get this thing started. I'd never been on a startup program where you had money like that to make the tools like you should start with. And we had one major change is on the wing, because we had an upper full one-piece wing skin, 40 feet long, basically. And a mess, and I said, we can't do that production-wise. So they ended up putting it in 5 pieces now. And I started at the third shift. And so that works. But you can see the automation that's going on here, and it's more sophisticated now. And they've moved this all onto the far side of the plant, anticipating the new long-range bomber program, so that they've got the room. That's where they built the V-2. And so it's a lot of technology in there, but I got a $175 million bill from Northrop Grumman that I wasn't expecting. They were looking for this, and what they had done is any of you actually interfaced with DCMA or DCAA? And they went to the people and actually talked them into the machines that they were building. Would not be capital equipment, it would be program specific. So that's the $175 million extra bill. Anyway, you're going to see the final article here, first shift, in a moment. And I was out there for the delivery of that. I was the youngest vice president at Northrop Grumman in the 80s, aircraft division, and some of the guys were still there in the assembly line that remembered me, and so I gave a speech, and I got a big round of applause. What the hell is that about? Yeah. And my boss gave a speech, and he didn't get that applause, and he said, what the hell is with this? And I said, well, a lot of those guys used to work with them. So that's why, it's nothing else. And so, anyway, we'll get through all this, and I want to get to the... But I wanted to see how much detail we went through to simulate all the activity. And probably should... here we go. We go to the next one is where we're going to do the make of the section. And we'll go into some detail on that. This is where, right there, make and moving line. And so we bring it in. Now it's a different configuration. I told you we went away from that one piece upper wing skin. And these things have been copied so much, the integrity of the pictures are not too good, but they were very crisp to start with. Now it's the center wing going in on top of the center fuselage. Now that center wing includes the fuselage now. It's the fuselage section. And Northrop wasn't too happy about that. Went through that, and I had to give the president a presentation on this. And I said, I found out that we got 144 mating surfaces to Don's people helped me determine that. And I said, there's likelihood of shimming and all that. We got to get rid of it, so we made the structure, the fuselage center section area, it went down the part of the wing. So we got rid of that. Northrop lost some business on that, so they didn't like it. But that's, now here we go for the moving line. Hired the same people that Boeing did for their moving line on 737. And they are Toyota retired executives. And we went through all these plans and had the people come together at different workstations and look at problems and problem solving before we ever got to the part. The only thing I ever had an argument with them on was I was paying the bill, and they had the CEO of the company come out and go through one of the exhibits, and I said, I want a hospital station. Got the hospital station for the mate now? That's what I saw when I was in there. I said, I want a hospital station because there's so many systems on this airplane. If I have a problem and can't keep that line going, I want to move it over. CEO said, no, we aren't going to do that. We don't do that at Toyota. I said, let's make this clear. Who's paying your bill? I said, I want the hospital station or you're fired. He went to the shop. And I said, you have the same thing, but you have it at the end of the line. He says, what do you mean? I said, I've been there. I can't stand it to be at the end of the line. I'm going to have it prior to that. Oops, we missed some.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, right there we go. Okay, the electronic modeling of the tools and so forth, looking for interfaces, problems, and clashes. The one thing that we did a physical mock-up on, when I looked at this IPP is the intern power plant, the first time it had ever been done, where you got the environmental system and the emergency power system all in one unit. And this is the most complicated area in the whole airplane. So I said, I want a mock-up of that. And the guys in material or supply chain found a company in California that did models for movies. And we got this for like $150,000. Cheap compared to what it would cost if we had built it. But it was a good thing because it was tight. You can see the mechanic's arm up there at the top of the picture. We found out that there were some engineering problems there. They had a little bit of mismatch on hooking up some of the components, so they had to go back to the design and redo that, and that was a lifesaver there. So we had Delmia Katia, his mock-up to evaluate all the producibility, including access to part building clashes. The physical mock-up I just talked about, that's basically the only one. We had one minor one in the cockpit, but it wasn't big. But the physical mock-up helped the mechanics understand how that thing was going to go in on the first airplane. And that can be used for training for the mechanics, and that's what we used it for. But without all this simulation, we would have a lot more problems. And we're talking about the tolerancing, and we use the common design or the solid modeling of every area on the airplane. And so you have, in stealth, you have gaps and mismatches that are critical. But you can't have very much of that. I want to tell one story. There was an Australian PhD, remember this, Don? And he was putting out articles when Australia was talking about buying the airplane. He says, I've looked at this structure, and this is not a stealth airplane. And he kept printing stuff like that. It's not a stealth airplane. So the first time it went through radar, he made sure that got announced. And that shut him up. Never heard from him. And so, don't know why. He thought it wasn't stealth, but here's one of the things I was going to mention. The automatic drilling on the wing skins and so forth and the forward fuselage skins. And the one thing that I fought with the State Department on was this thing right here. Built at Northrop Grumman, which is the inlet duct. It's all one piece. Really complicated. And the machinery it takes to do that is phenomenal. And they ship that to Turkey for them to build. So I said, you're putting them in the business. And you don't know what the government's going to be like in Turkey another 2 or 3 years. Well, guess what we got hitting Turkey right now? He's a conservative Muslim. And I said, how long do you, at the time, I said, how long do you think it's going to take that technology to get to Iran? Well, we've already made up our mind. Worse than shooting yourself in the foot. Anyway, And this flexible overhead gantry is how we machine the skins for the periphery and the inside pockets access covers. That's a $21 million bill installed. Very accurate. Now, I had an argument with the CEO of that company, DPS, out of Germany. And I think Don heard some repercussions of my comments on this. I said, the machining tool is not doing the tolerances that you said. It's got a laser alignment system on it and all that. I said, it's not working. It's not holding the tolerance. And he says, well, what are we going to do about it? I said, here's what you're going to do. You're going to get your engineers out here because I'm going to start cutting production parts. And that better be holding the tolerance. And he said, well, I don't know if I can do that. I said, I'm going to tell you a story. And this is when I told the Lockheed people. I said, in 1986, I had the Swiss build me a machine tool that held plus or minus 42 millions. Now, a bunch of people at Lockheed thought I was in that when I said that. I didn't dare tell them about the beryllium company that Don and I were talking about before we started here. I managed a beryllium company, and that's all they did. And that was plus or minus 5 million. So anyway, another story. So that got solved. They had to come in and put more coolant through the head and also change the whole air conditioning system in the building, because this is a building within the building, as you saw on the tour. The other one is the precision milling machine. That was $17 million installed, and that's where you do the machining of the forward fuselage structure or put the skins on. Excuse me. Here's the automatic drilling machine, and that's a six-axis. It's got two heads. You see the one here, there's another one here. They're independent. But the way that we started using that is you go from like the center out, and they start drilling off the holes. As you see on that, there's a little over 3,000 holes drilled in that. 2,200 of them were countersunk or counterbored. All of them are good. And that's, if you're building airplanes, the most rejections you have is on holes. And that's why we said we've got to automate. Get out of that problem. Took 28 hours. Now the testing challenges on this airplane, I can tell you something since it's been told to through Aviation Leak. People used to ask us all the time, why were we doing an F-35 when we got an F-22? Now the F-22 will outperform an F-35 in speed and so forth in range. But what they didn't realize is the F-22's computers process a little over 3.5 million lines of code. And the F-35 is over 8 million lines of code. Now we can't tell you about all the systems that, but you can kind of figure there must be a lot of capability the F-22 doesn't have, and that's correct. That's why all that computer power. And the testing had to be done with a 1394-bit data bus developed for this airplane. And so that's what we used to go through and test all the systems. We came up with a matrix. On the F-22, we called what we had. Apple built us a big computer called Big Mac. But it didn't have all the capabilities that this matrix machine. And the X's on there was actually put on there for experimental at the time. And we had power on. I want to tell you a little story about power on. General C.R. Davis, the month before power on, I was giving my presentation, and he says, Linhart, when we go to power on September the 7th, that does not mean a light in the right hand. Well, guess what Linhart did? Comes September the 7th, when we're going to have power on, and I told the guys running the assembly line there, I said, go get one of those lamps that clap on, clamp on. And so they did, and we put that in the right hand end and put the big sign, clap on, clap off, going out there. And General Davis, he looks at me and says, what's that mean? I said, the light came on. He said, USOP. And we had a good laugh on that, and then we turned the power on. Now, here's one of the things that you learn some problems with the inexperienced engineering folks. And we turned every system that we had on the airplane on through that matrix. So I told the guys, I said, you check everything that we've got on and tell me what consumption we have. And guess what? The generator on the airplane was not big enough to carry the load. Mm-hmm. So we had to go in for a redesign on the generator, and I thought, well, that's going to affect first flight. And they said, no, those keep down to minimum systems for him to fly, and we won't turn everything on. And so that's how we made first flight. But that was a, you know, call the head of engineering down and said, what do you got going on here, guys? Not much. So that's where a lot of the experience comes in that I've had a real fortunate situation to be a part of. And my basic training ground was Douglas or McDonnell Douglas. And they rotated me. I was a high potential person, and they rotated me every 18 months through different organizations and stuff. I couldn't pay for that. But a 128 system checkout procedures using that, and it's being used today. Now, here's Cody's. These are 8-axis robots. Do the coding. Because you put the secret sauce on the airplane, and guess what? You can't have a person in there while that's spraying. Put on 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So you have to have robots do the spray. And this is the component finish, meaning the areas where you can't get to when you've got the assembly put together, so you've got the coating on it. And then you have a final coating put on the whole airplane after it's assembled and flight tested. There's another story. Pratt & Whitney bought that company. And CEO Pratt & Whitney and myself ended up being actually cell phone tag people. Because he wasn't smart enough. His people weren't smart enough to put a contract out for the people that owned this company to stay with the company for 5 years or something like that before they let him go. They just walked out the door. Supply chain performance. And the digital thread helps achieve the close tolerances as we've talked about, and I won't go into a lot more on that, but this BTP here is built to parts, or plan, and you go through the different segments. We had manufacturing engineers. Don had his manufacturing engineers up there working with the design people as they were designing a lot of this. And so that made it easier to catch some of the things. And I found out later, some of the guys were not listened to, and engineering just bored straight on down the line. And that ended up being a fight between me and the VP of engineering. Reduced lead times and shortened span times. Here's the chronology, kind of, and why it was successful. Excellent producibility results. Quality far exceeded legacy results. Now, here's one where I had an internal fight in the company's quality organization. The rejections that we had on the very first airplane were 45% of the legacy F-16 that was in production at that time. And it's all due to that digital thread we were talking about. And they had just the blueprints before. Naturally, it's an old airplane. And even on the F-22, we were about 52% of the rejections that they had as they were in production. First airplane. So we started assembly on May 14, 2004. And by the way, all this simulation was almost complete. All of it was almost complete before we ever started that assembly. And that was just a bulkhead in the assembly jig that started assembly. Components were mated on June 7, 2005. Power on. That's when I was talking about the light and the intake. September 7th, and then roll out to the fuel barn. This is one I was really interested in. February 17th, 2006. Stick test performed, no leaks. Every airplane that I've been involved in my history, when you went out with the first airplane, leaked. So I asked the guy running the wing line, because that's where most of the sealing was done. I said, ask you this question. Who is the best sealer that you've got? And so he gave me a name, Paul Fisher. And I said, I want to meet him. And I said, and you're going to use him to train every sealer we've got on this line. Because when that plane goes to the fuel barn, I do not want to hear about leaks. And that's the result. We did the EIPP runs on September the 2nd, 2006, and engine runs on September 14th, and that included idle, military, and afterburner. Some of you may not know what that means. Idle, you certainly do. Mill power is when you take the throttle and you push it all the way forward, you get a detent. And that's full throttle without afterburner. And then you have to hit it, it's according to which airplane you're in, hit a little detent and then go on to afterburner. So when we went into afterburner, we were standing out there outside the area where they had it housed on the flight line. Our insides vibrate when they put it in afterburner. Just the vibration from it. That's now, and that's another argument I had with engineering about a joint that I wanted to have on the wings that they wouldn't let me have because of weight. I said, you don't understand, this engine is going to grow in thrust over time. We're talking about 400 pounds of weight, and now that engine, instead of 40,000 pounds of thrust, is 4,200. 42,000 pounds of thrust. And a lot of people don't understand that, not grew up with this. If you look at the first engines from Pratt & Whitney that we had for F-15, F-14, and F-16, were called the Pratt & Whitney F-100. When they started, they had 17,000 pounds of thrust. And the same engine now, and I got to fly it in December of 2004, I got to fly the F-16, that had the most powerful engine at the time, is 29,500. So that growth happens, and the big reason for that is because they brought GE in on the contract, and they started being a battle who could get the most thrust. And that's why I would like to see GE in on this, to have a competition. But it's going to grow. First flight was December 15, 2006, and I was there in the control tower when that happened. And the thing that really impressed me is we had two F-16s that were chase planes for this. So John Beasley was the chief test pilot and the grandpa flying this first flight. And he put it in mill power, which is all the way to the detent, to take off. F-16s were already in the air, and they had to put their afterburners on it, and he had to back off for them to catch it. Mm-hmm. On the first flights, you don't ever go in the afterburner, so that's down the line. But that was what impressed me. I said, oh, Michael, this is going to be a fast guy. So anyway, to go to this, if you got any other questions, hopefully I didn't bore you to death. but it was a good thing, and Tom Burbidge was the program manager for this when I took the job. And the reason that I got the job was the guy that became the president out here, he's retired now, was there as the program manager on the F-22. He said, we need somebody to take over the F-35. And I said, why would I do that? Because I was already semi-retired and consulting for them on the F-22. And he said, go talk to Tom Burbidge. So they read me in on the program, and I saw all the different technologies that were going to be used. And I said, holy mackerel, that's good. And now, what I'd like to do is show you a short video that we do have to have U.S. citizens on.
Yeah, hold on. Y'all ask more questions because we got to get the video ready.
Any questions?
When you're overhauling that engine, you said that the power plant couldn't support the necessary power for it, but the generator wasn't integrated onto the engine?
Oh, sure.
But it was easier to ask us to take that off without major modifications for the engine?
Well, yeah, no modifications to the engine other than the attach points. For the generator. Yeah.
So just curious, it's kind of on the same thing. when you were doing all of your simulations and stuff, did your load wind up being more than you had designed, or was there...
When we were doing the simulations, we didn't do the simulations for the power.
Okay.
We didn't do that until we didn't have the capability of doing that at the time. It was a lot involved. That's kind of the matrix that you saw was actually the proving ground.
Okay.
And when it did all 128 systems checkouts, that's when we found out we didn't have enough power in the generator. Yeah. There's some other stories. I got a lot of war stories. One of the things that I had to complain about, and you guys that are here at the university, engineering is a real problem today, getting experienced people. And when we were doing this program and Boeing was starting the 787, I mean, there wasn't enough engineers yet, so we got people right out of college. There were tube jockeys, and I was the industry chairman of the advisory board for Cal State Los Angeles back in 1986 through 88. And I was hiring engineers at the time, and I told the dean of engineering, I'm not going to hire another one of your engineers. And he says, why is that? And I said, they can't think in 3D. You do not teach them how to think in 3D. And it takes a long time for them to come up to speed to visualize things, and they think the computer's going to do everything for them, and they will not. It's a tool. Mm-hmm. And so I said, the only way I'm going to do that is if you start them on the board first. On the board. I said, yes, on the board. That's the way I started. I said, I want you to have them draw isometric views of all kinds of different kind of parts. That'll help them start to get an idea how to think 3D. And no matter about the politics, but did you hear a statement by Ben Carson saying one of the most difficult things he had was to think in 3D?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's an issue. And there's not enough experienced engineers to take this on down the line. And one thing I always worried about is the actuators on this airplane was the first time it's ever been done. And that was when you have a concealed unit. You don't have anything but a power cord running to it. And no hydraulics. It's all, the hydraulics are all self-contained. Dual path redundancy. And I said heat. It's going to be the main concern because I had a contract from Wright-Patterson one time to build an actuator that was supposed to move 180 degrees per second. And we couldn't do it because we couldn't dissipate the heat. But we had a 50 horsepower electric motor that was only that big in diameter, about that long. And that time it was heat. They still had some heat problems, but they had some other problems too. But it works. Yes.
Ed, more and more composite materials are getting used in airframes. Do, in your experience at Lockheed, are designers starting to embrace designing with composites to get the most out of them, or are they still designing like black aluminum parts?
Well, there's certain kinds, and I had experience on that with a NASA contract on a DC-10 vertical stabilizer back in the 70s. And what we had is the NASA wanted us to build 10 vertical stabilizers for DC-10s and put them on the airplane to fly. And the problem we had was the designers were doing exactly what you said.
Mm-hmm.
They were sheet metal and machine part designers with skins, and now this was all composite. So they made the same kind of parts. They didn't have to do it. It was all integrated, you know, integral parts. They finally learned that lesson as a result of that, but yeah, we still have some of them that are like that, not thinking outside the box. Mm-hmm. Now, Boeing kind of went overboard. I got invited down to South Carolina to visit the center fuselage on the 787 with the center wing box in it. And the guy's taking me on a tour, and I've got another horror stories about that, but I won't bore you with them today. But I looked at that, and I said, you guys aren't going to make the fatigue test on this airplane. He says, why? I said, I'm looking, my calibrated eyes are looking at skins that are coming out on top of that wing box. It looks like about 3/16 of an inch thick. I said, I know what every thickness is of every inner wing on Boeing airplanes, and the minimum you have is 1 1/4 thick aluminum at the mate joint. And I said, you're going to fail. 4 weeks later, they failed in the fatigue. And I ran a fatigue lab for a while, so that's how We've got to understand some of this stuff. When you look at our skins, what are the skins of the inner portion on our composite wing area? Is it about a one inch, something like that?
Well, they used to be. They're probably 400, 300 to 400, yeah.
Yeah.
With a new design.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was almost 1 inch before, and so that was composite.